like to give a talk on the area of decision making. How do we make decisions? How do we choose what is right and what is wrong? What is the appropriate thing to do? How do we make judgments in life and direct our path and choose our direction in a way which is going to be skillful and beneficial? I want to bring this into the context of the area of what the Buddha called bhavana, which is the area of cultivation. And the word bhavana in Buddhism means cultivation. In English, it is often translated as meditation. But in the Buddhist context, the word that the Buddha used for meditation has a much broader meaning than just, say, sitting here, closing our eyes and calming the mind. The word bhavana has a meaning of cultivation, and it means to cultivate in goodness or cultivate in a path which is going to lead to one's spiritual development and progress, to one's maturity in truth, to developing those spiritual qualities of peace, tranquility, wisdom, calm, compassion, and understanding. We notice when we're presented with situations in life and situations that arise, we make decisions, usually in terms of three different things. We use three categories, or three ways of approaching a problem. And usually our problems arise because of change. Without change, there's stability. But it's when we're presented with change, new circumstances in life, new situations, or old situations that change, then it is that resistance to the change which causes suffering. Because one of the things that the Buddha saw profoundly on the night of his enlightenment, that all phenomena, there's nothing in this world of physical form or mental phenomena that is permanent, lasting, stable, and never changing. It is all changing. Everything you can point to, everything you can detail, is in a constant state of vibration, flux, and change. It is never still or stable. We see that from physics, isn't it? Don't we? There is just vibration, there's a chaos theory that everything is in this chaotic state of change. When we start to see that, if we try to have things never change, to be stable, to be constant, to be permanent, then we're going to be disappointed, because the very nature of things is to change. And so we should expect change, look for change, and view change. If we don't expect things to change, then we're trying to ignore the reality of phenomena. And it is this ignorance, this ignoring, not willingness or not open to change, which actually causes and is the root cause of all our suffering. So when we're presented with change, or we're presented with life's problems and difficulties, usually we make a decision about that situation in terms of self, that is our own worldview. How's this affect me? Or what's in it for me? What's my opinion? How do I look on this? What do I like? And have you ever noticed how often we say, this is good? Because we're really saying, I like this. this particular food. Oh, this is really good. We're really using the word I like there in exchange for the word good. And it's very often what we say is good is really we're saying I agree with, I like, I prefer. And when we start to notice this, then we see that other people may say something else is good from their point of view because they too are saying, this I like, I agree with, I prefer. This is in accordance with my view, my attitudes. So this is how many people make their decisions in the world. Is it in accordance with my feelings, my preferences, my likes, my desires? Or is it against? And if it is against our feelings, our likes, our desires and our preferences, and then we say, I don't like that. I don't want that. I don't prefer that. And then, because of that, then there's resistance. There's aversion arising in the mind. And then other people, or even ourselves, make other decisions because it's in accordance with the views of the world. Fashions of the world. So if a majority agree on certain things, they say, then that must be right. But that doesn't necessarily make that situation right or true, just because a majority agrees on it. A majority of people can agree to go to war. But does that necessarily make it right or true? Does it necessarily make that wise and skillful behavior? A majority of people may say that this person has committed a crime, so should be executed. Does that make that necessarily true or right? Just because a majority agree doesn't necessarily make that decision a wise decision. It can be, because it is in accordance to the majority of wise people, but it doesn't necessarily act in that correlation. It's not necessarily so that because it's a democratic decision of a majority, that that decision is wholesome. That doesn't necessarily make that approach, that decision, right. So what we see is that because of a decision being made by society or by a majority or by a fashionable agreement, that doesn't make that decision necessarily correct or right. There are other ways of deciding on something. Whether that is ethical, whether that's moral, whether that's appropriate, whether that's right. And that's whether it's in accordance with truth, whether it's in accordance with what we call Dhamma. And Dhamma is not something which is owned by Buddhists, it's owned and it's natural, it is there in the world, it is owned by nobody. It just is. And how do we define what is true? It is something which, if we act in that way, it has no negative consequences for ourselves or others. It brings benefit to ourselves and brings benefit to others. It brings happiness to ourselves and happiness to others. It is something which is ethical in this regard, that is for our own development. And this is where we see how compassion works, that if I'm going to do something, then not only do I have to consider how it affects me, but with compassion in the mind, I have to think of how it affects others. How does the things that I do, I say, and I think affect the people around me. And that's when we consider the consequences of our actions, an act of compassion. Because compassion is the quality of not wanting to inflict pain or suffering on oneself or another or any other being. And that's an act of compassion, wanting to relieve suffering within oneself and in other and all other living beings. And so when we act out of compassion, we're acting in a way which considers consequences. How do the things that I do and say affect other people? And that sensitivity to oneself, and sensitivity to others, sensitivity to our life, and sensitivity to the lives of others. This is compassion, where we're not looking at terms of, I like this, therefore I'll do it. I like to speak in this way, therefore I'll speak in that way. I saw that a while back someone showed me an article about an artist who had done quite an outrageous painting, and in that artwork it was very hurtful and injurious to the Christian faith, and they had used Christian symbolism along with elephant dung to make a painting, and a lot of the Christian people felt very offended and upset. And the defense of the artist was, well, that's their problem. You know, I'm there to shock people. I'm there to challenge people. I'm there, that's my role, is to make people sit up and wake up. Is that necessarily a compassionate viewpoint? It may be a viewpoint of what one thinks, my personal feeling, my perception. That's what that person wants to do, is to go around shocking people because they feel that that's important. But is that wise? Is it good to upset people because of their beliefs and their faiths? Isn't that another form of intolerance? Isn't that another form of selfishness? That I have a right to shock you? I thought about that, and I wondered what that artist would think if someone went in and hacked up the Mona Lisa. Would they get upset? No one should damage art, because that's what they hold dear. To do something which damages the beliefs that someone else holds dear, they think that is allowable. And that's coming from this viewpoint of self, where we choose what I want to do, what I want to say, or how I want to act, because I think I'm right, and therefore I'm justified, and therefore I have the right to do what I want, do how I want, when I want, where I want. And that's focusing on the view of self. And from a Buddhist point of view, that's focusing on the self. And when we focus on the self, it's another phrase for selfishness. Selfishness is the quality where we give self over importance, and we view the world in terms of me, mine. So we will view how we speak in terms of what we think is appropriate for ourselves, not necessarily the effect it may have on others. We will view the world, and I want to behave in this way, and I don't give a care how others feel or may be offended or whatever. And that comes from this sense of placing self above everything else. Now there's another way, as I said before, is where we place the opinions of others above everything else. That also, as I said, can be wrong as well, or not correct, in that we say, well, this is how the world says this is right, this is true, this is fashionable, this is correct, and therefore I must act in that way, and I believe that. We all know and can see examples of that in the world where that can be not correct. We can also see that there are other ways of decision making. And so the Buddha was encouraging us to reflect on the consequences of something, not out of a belief in what he said or not out of a belief in what a teacher says. There's that famous discourse he gave to the Kalamas. One time the Buddha was traveling through an area of India, and he came across a village, and it was the people of the village were called the Kalamas. They came to him and they said, Venerable Sir, we're very confused. And he said, why? And he said, well, we get some religious leaders come to our village and say, my teachings is right, correct and true, and all other teachers are wrong. Then they go away, and then another teacher comes along, religious teacher, and says, my teachings are right, correct and true, and they uplift themselves and disparage others. And then they go away. And so we don't know who to believe. Everyone who comes says that. And the Buddha's response was, yes, it's worthy of being confused. And then he said that, Kalamas, I suggest that you don't take anything just because it's written in a holy book. You don't take anything on board because it's said by a particular person or your teacher or because it agrees with your views that you already have or that it sounds reasonable, that you don't take anything on board because it seems logical that could be true, or that you don't take anything on board as an opinion as a guiding life principle because you like it. And you don't take anything on board because it says this is an ancient tradition, therefore you should believe it. It is preferable that you take something aside, some teaching, some instruction from any religious leader, and consider, is this, if I apply it in my life, beneficial to myself, beneficial to others, and beneficial to both? If I do this thing, does it have consequences to myself, and consequences to others, and consequences to both? And what are those consequences? Are they wholesome consequences or unwholesome consequences? And it's only when you've considered something very seriously in this way should you then reflect, if I do this, will this increase in my happiness or decrease my happiness? Will it increase others' happiness or decrease their happiness? And then, after wise consideration, seeing for yourself, should you then take on that form of practice rather than out of belief in a tradition, in scripture, in a teacher, in rationality, in logic, in reason, in ancient tradition. They're not good grounds. Paraphrasing the Buddha, they're not good grounds for saying this must be true because it's written down. This must be true because it's an ancient tradition. This must be true because this person said so. But it's only after wise consideration. And then he went on and said, Kalamas, is it reasonable to say that if a person whose mind is overcome with greed, and that person overcome with greed goes out and kills for the sake of greed, goes out and takes and steals out of greed, goes out and commits adultery or abuses other people's partners and loved ones out of greed, or lies and deceives out of greed, takes drugs and intoxicants and becomes careless and heedless just out of sensual pleasure and greed. Is that wise? Is that praised by the wise? And they said, no, it's not praised by the wise. Is that beneficial to yourself? And the Kalama said, no, it's not beneficial to myself. Is it beneficial to others? And they could see, and just as we can see, it is not beneficial to others either, obviously. And so the Buddha said, having seen that these five things are not useful to yourself, not useful to others, not beneficial and compassionate to yourself, or compassionate to others, then those things should be abandoned. And the Buddha went on to repeat the same statements about a mind which is overcome by anger and kills out of anger, steals out of hatred, commits adultery with hatred and ill will as a cause, lies with hatred and aversion as a cause, takes drugs and intoxicants out of self-hatred because a person cannot be at peace with themselves as a cause. And then he went on to say the same, motivated by delusion. If you see that these things are not praised by the wise, not beneficial to yourself, not beneficial to others, not beneficial to both, then should those things be abandoned within oneself? And the Kalama people said that they thought that it should be abandoned within oneself because it doesn't bring happiness to oneself and happiness to others and happiness to both. And that's the ethical standard. And so the Buddha wasn't telling those people, the Kalamas, to say, believe in me, I know the true and only way to freedom, and everyone else is damned for eternal damnation. He was saying, be wise, be your own refuge, be your own judge, and be an island to yourself. Seek out your own wisdom. But don't make decisions just in terms of what you like, that must be true, and what you don't like, that must be false, or what other people like, that must be true, and what they don't like is false. But make a decision considering all round it, how it affects oneself and its consequences, and how it affects those around you, and is it beneficial to both. This is the ethical standard we can use. And I think if we are reflective, we start to notice the consequences of what we do and how we do it, how it affects ourselves and others. So I want to use this and bring this into the context of what the Buddha called bhavana, as cultivation. And he talked about cultivation in terms of four things. That is gaya bhavana, cultivation of the body. Sila bhavana, cultivation of this virtue. Citta bhavana, cultivation of states of peace. And panya bhavana, cultivation of wisdom. And this cultivation of the body means being aware of this physical form and how when we move through the world, it affects us. If we abuse this body, drugs and intoxicants, we abuse his body with heedlessness, then it's going to have consequences, won't it? It's when we don't see the consequences, we think it doesn't matter. Then later on, down the road, we will suffer. And having been to many funerals, like suicides, you see that some people have abused the body and think their problems in life are to do with the body. If their life ended, then their problems would end. But the problems are not in the body. The problems are in the mind. It's the mind which is unhappy. It's the mind which is depressed. It is mind which cannot resolve the situations and problems that arise. And the body is just a vehicle. It does things ordered by the mind. So it's where our mind goes. The mind is the forerunner, the Buddha said, of all things. What your mind thinks about, then it will incline in that way, and then it will become a habit. That habit will then lead to patterns of speech and patterns of behavior. So it's cultivating the body. And when we cultivate the body, we have to develop a social awareness of how our body, how we use our body, how we move our body in time and space, and in particular situations and environments, don't we? Obviously in all societies and all communities, there are certain etiquette, certain standards, there's certain ways of behavior which are socially agreed on, that this is appropriate, this is reasonable. This is acceptable in that particular place, in that particular environment. Obviously, what you would do in a place like this, which is a spiritual place, or a place like a church or a mosque, you know, your ways of interacting, your ways of deportment, your ways of dress, it would be appropriate for that time, that place. The one would be rising up to that spiritual place. It's very different if we'll go to the shops, or we go to the beach, or we go somewhere else. There's a different social standard. And that's just convention, isn't it? We accept the convention and we know, oh, this is what I do in this environment. This is appropriate. So that we're considerate of ourselves and considerate of others and considerate of both. This sensitivity to how we cultivate the body and use the body, use this body as a vehicle for good. Because having had this body, we can use it for our own growth and as a vehicle for good, or we can use it as an indulgence to seek pleasure from it and take advantage of others. And we know if we're going on a spiritual journey, then we're trying to use this body and using its energy, using its abilities to be beneficial to ourselves and others. So we look for ways of giving service. How can I help those in need? How can I give physical assistance with this body? How can I give material help to other people's bodies? Those who are poor, those who are depressed, those who are sad, those who are going without. How can I give the material needs to sustain their bodies? This is how we develop the body, by giving to others, servicing them, their needs, their helps, their desires. And then there's the whole level of what we call sila bhavana, the cultivation of virtue. This is the foundation stone of all spiritual development, is this quality of virtue. And as I said, in the Buddhist tradition, virtue is five things. The quality of harmlessness. And harmlessness is a noble idea. But if you're developing harmlessness, you'll notice you'll always be challenged. What do you do when the ants come into your house? What do you do when you find you've got white ants under the floorboards? What do you do to those creatures we consider pests and distractions. We have to use our skill, our wisdom, and we also are motivated by compassion. Know that all living creatures seek happiness and avoid pain. And as we become more and more sensitive, then we find we can live quite harmlessly in the world. As a monk, I live in the world. Yes, you're in a monastery, but still, there are these things that come into our huts. The monks are all scratching at the moment because they're being bitten by ticks, because we've got lots of kangaroos in our monastery. And lots of kangaroos, there's lots of ticks on the kangaroos. So we just accept that. That's just part of life. If we get aversion to the itch, to the scratch, then we're going to get aversion to the ticks, we're going to get aversion to the kangaroos. That's just part of the process. They come and they go. We've got the wisdom to know that the ticks come during the hot season. When it rains, they will go. So all the monks at the moment are hoping it will rain, and so the ticks will go. There's just this harmlessness. You can actually, not going out to want to get rid of the hate and have aversion towards those things. They just come and they go. They're just passing through. They're not there forever. And we can develop this sense of honesty and truthfulness. It's a very touching. Just the other day, I was speaking to a friend of mine, Venerable Kalyano, Ajahn Kalyano, who's setting up a monastery in Melbourne. And he's just been donated some land. And it's in East Warburton, for those who know Victoria, a very beautiful part of Melbourne, and just the outskirts of Melbourne, out of the city. And it's a very beautiful forest. But after they bought the land, a year later, someone else bought the neighbouring property. And then when they heard that there was going to be a monastery there, they decided that they would stop the monastery being built. So when they applied for their planning permission, this person put up a lot of resistance and did a lot of PR work to have the monastery not established. And the other day it was the decision, the council decision, and it could have gone either way, whether to allow this monastery to go ahead or not. And he said that one of the councillors spoke at the meeting, and he said one of the most touching things he said was that, I've got to know these monks over a period of time. I've walked around the property, and in my interaction with them, I trust them. And I said to Ajahn Kalyano, that is one of the most supreme and highest things that someone can say to you. That is really, you've created truth there because of your integrity over that time. If you can instill in somebody who's not a Buddhist, who's not pushing your barrow, as they so to speak, it is a neutral observer who has to make a decision about you, and that person in that interaction can say, I trust you, then that's one of the highest qualities or highest compliments that someone can give to another human being. And very fortunately from that, the decision did go according to the monks. They're allowed to build the monastery. But I was very moved just to hear those words. That it's actually something we see, that when there is integrity, then it does bring out the best in people. And as a monk, often I'm very, very touched just by how some people who don't know anything about Buddhism, but because they recognize you are trying to live according to this spiritual path, then it brings out the best in them and they do something for you. The other day, we had to call in with our monastery van because We had to get some mechanical work done on it, and we called into the garage on the way back to the monastery. The owner of the garage saw the monk sitting in. He sort of waved and said hello. And we made an appointment for the van to be brought back the next day to be worked on. And after it was worked on, one of our laymen took it down. And the man repaired the van. And afterwards he said, well, how much is it? And he said, well, it's about $70, but you don't have to pay. And he said, well, why not? And he said, well, you know, I appreciate what the monks are doing. And when the layman came back and told me that, you know, when I sat in meditation, I purposely spread loving kindness to that proprietor of that garage. May he be prosperous, may he be happy, may he be successful in his business. You know, because you can see just that he didn't have to do that. He was moved to do an act of generosity, an act of kindness. And that's just so uplifting in the world when we do small acts of generosity and kindness, unasked for, unrequested, undemanded. We do that for somebody else in this world. How that just creates an atmosphere of goodness, an atmosphere of wholesomeness. And we can change society. We can change the way other people then, having received that act, do other acts of kindness to others. And we see how this honesty and integrity is cultivating and growing in that quality, making it mature in our hearts. But when we develop these qualities, you know, in our five precepts, we'll always be challenged, won't we? There'll always be, you know, those temptations. There'll always be, you know, should I or shouldn't I? You know, that decision that we have to make. We're brought to the challenge at this point in this time, and that's actually when you have to practice. And when we're sitting here in this room, we're ever actually not challenged according to our five precepts, are we? We're not talking, we're not lying, we're not doing anything inappropriate. So we're not actually practicing, training the mind according to virtue. We're not cultivating virtue at this particular point. It's only when, you know, a difficulty, a temptation, something arises, when we have to make a moral decision, an ethical decision. What should I do? Should I go left or right? That's when we're challenged, and that's when we actually have to decide. And we have to know for ourselves. And we're our own witness, aren't we? We know what we choose to do. We at least we see. At least we know. Maybe no one else in the world sees what we do, but we know. And so we become our own minds, become our own judges. You'll find that the more we cultivate in virtue, the more you develop a sense of inner integrity and inner happiness, inner confidence. Because when you make a judgment, how have I behaved in life? How have I behaved? How have I acted? Then you cannot criticize yourself. There's no remorse. There's no guilt. Because you've tried your best. You've trying to improve and try to do what is right and skillful. Sometimes, yes, we fall down and make mistakes. But the Buddhist path is not a path of thou shalt not, but it's a training. I know I will fall down, but I'll train myself to try again, to improve, to grow, to develop, to cultivate. So we water the tree of goodness. We water the tree of virtue. And so there's integrity in our relationships with others. There's honesty and truthfulness in our speech, but also care and kindness. So that when we're saying, not saying, well, you know, I think you should know this, so I'm going to tell you. We consider how that will affect others. And there's care and integrity in how we treat our own bodies and mind with drugs and intoxicants. And the Buddha told us not to drink, because there's consequences. We see that. Having had a lot of interaction with people in AA, people who have addictions, either drug addictions, alcohol addictions, or gambling addictions, it always starts somewhere. And so it's better not to start. And people always assume, I can control, I'm in control, I can give it up at any time. If one can give it up at any time, then give it up. If you can't give it up, you're addicted. You're attached. There's something holding you there. There's something that says, one more time, I enjoy it, I like it. And that's for you to decide. But also consider the downfalls, consider the consequences. Consider, are you really in control? If you're really happy, you don't need it. The enlightened doesn't need it. So if you really want enlightenment, you'll find it's not necessary. It's a distraction. It's very coarse. Yes, there's pleasure. It's a very coarse and minor pleasure compared to the pleasure and joy and rapture of the mind, which goes to tranquility and calm. And that's next level of mental cultivation, what we call citta bhavana. Citta in Buddhism means the heart or the mind. Why do we use this combination of the word heart-mind? Because and the Buddha is not saying that we think with our brains. He's saying we think with our heart-mind, with the citta, which is that in our minds there's also feeling. When you're broken-hearted, you don't say, I'm broken-headed. Yes? It's the feeling is in the heart. When there's fear, where does that occur? People say, you know, I have a gut feeling. There is feelings are felt within the whole mind. But actually, citta is not located anywhere in the body. It is a quality of knowing. The mind is not located necessarily in the brain. It's a quality of knowing. And that there is feelings that are known. And sometimes we try to locate them physically, but really, they're just known. And so we call it this general word of the heart-mind. So it includes both thinking, conceptualization, opinions and views and ideas and concepts, but also emotions and feelings. Feelings of joy and feelings of love and feelings of compassion, feelings of sorrow. They all occur in this mind. And so we're trying to cultivate the mind. We're trying to cultivate the mind so it grows. And this is part of the spiritual path. Actually, I was just joking with somebody the other day, kind of having a scientific sort of bent. I was saying that meditation, M, I have a little kind of physical formula for it. M equals P C to the power of 10. And M is meditation equals P is for peace and C is for clarity. So peace times clarity to the power of 10 equals meditation. The more peace you have, it will bring greater happiness, greater rapture, greater joy. That times clarity, because the greater the peace, the more clarity it will bring. Clarity means wisdom and understanding. Because when you see something very clearly, then you understand it. You notice that sometimes we've sort of suddenly understood something. The penny has dropped and we go, oh, that's how it works. That's the problem. That's where I've been caught. That's when that clarity, that understanding has arisen. And we can suddenly see something in a way we've never seen it before. We've never understood the problem that way before. And we can resolve it and bring it to an end. And so the more we purify the mind of greed and hatred and delusion, then the greater clarity arises. And so that's why we practice meditation, Meditation is a way of calming the mind down, relaxing. But not only relaxing, taking it to a place of stillness, peace and joy. So enjoy your meditation. When you meditate, smile like the Buddha. You know, you see some meditators, I'm going to do it. You know, and there's no joy there. And joy is one of the factors of enlightenment. And it is one of the factors that will take you to peace. Find joy in a wholesome meditation subject, be it on loving kindness or compassion or on the breath. Enjoy it with this sense of just serene joy. It's not this giggly, effervescent joy. It's a serenity. You notice that, you know, Buddhist artwork, the Buddha has a very serene smile. That is, this quality of enlightenment is described as serenity. And so these words, when we're sitting meditation, think of these words. Have a serene smile in the mind. Look on things serenely. Look on situations more calmly. Look on the mind with a sense of ease and well-being, tranquility. And when things settle down, then they become much more clearer. And when they become clearer, then we can see them as they really are. And then that leads to this other quality of what we call panya bhavana, the cultivation of wisdom. And wisdom in Buddhism, and we hear the word wisdom, and we often hear the word enlightenment, but these qualities have a specific meaning in Buddhism and are very well defined. The quality of wisdom is the ability to see and understand something and then let it go. So we start to see where our problems arise from, understand that, and then let them go. So we're starting to see, what's the cause? Why am I suffering? And so this wisdom can be developed through serenity, but it also can be developed through investigation, inquiry. So if you're suffering, you know, if you're unhappy, if you're feeling dis-ease, ask yourself, why? What do I want? What am I trying to get rid of? Why am I discontent? And listen to the answer. I want this. I don't want that. If only they had done this. If only they didn't do that. Listen to that. And we hear the if only, the desire coming up. Behind all discontentment, behind all suffering, is some form of desire, some form of wanting, some urge, some need, or some of urge to get rid of and annihilate. And so when we start to see the cause, we start to see the primal driving of suffering as desire, then we can do something about it. What do we abandon? We abandon the desire. The problem grows out of that thing. So we abandon the desire. When we abandon the desire which is making us discontent, then what is left? If there's no cause, contentment will arise. We abandon the cause for discontentment, contentment arises. And this is what we call wisdom. Wisdom in Buddhism means bringing something to the end of suffering, or bringing suffering to its end. And so we're always challenged in life. Problems and difficulties are always arising because of the nature of change. I remember some people would come to see Ajahn Chah in Thailand, and he would talk about the underlying nature of suffering. And because most of these people were very healthy, young, traveling, wealthy Western people, they would often say to him, "I'm not suffering. I don't have any suffering. Let's just talk about suffering." And often it's because they never sat still enough, because they're always distracting themselves from looking. So one of his usual responses, "Well, if you're not suffering, just sit here. Just sit here like myself for half an hour." And they were sitting on a cold concrete floor, and usually within half an hour they were already wriggling. And he said, "No, don't move. Why are you moving? Well, you said you're not suffering. Why are you moving? If you're not suffering, just still, be still." And of course, within an hour, they were in agony. And they say, "You know, why are you moving?" "Because I've got pain." "What's that pain? And why are you moving?" "It's the avoidance of the pain is always what makes us move from one thing to another. And we're looking for distraction in entertainment, in what's in the fridge, what's on the telly, what's in the newspapers. We're always looking for something to take us away from the experience of what's going on. We're distracting ourselves because we're always moving away from the discomfort, trying to look for comfort. And that's what restlessness is, isn't it? One cannot rest. Peace is the ability to be perfectly still, regardless of what's going on. Even if there's pain going on, one can be perfectly still. Not still with ignorance, but still with knowing. There can be pain and know it. Oh, it's just pain arising and passing away. Comes and goes. There's no owner there. It's just like the waves coming in against the shore, breaking and then going out again. No one owns those waves. No one owns the clouds. No one owns the leaves in the forest. They just arise and they pass away. When we start to see that this is nature, this body and mind is a part of nature, things arise and pass away, then we start to let go. We're not clinging on to things. We're not forcing them to be according to our likes, our desires, our wishes, our hopes. We know it comes and goes. There's always change there. And so we let go. We abandon. We put things down. We don't carry it around. And this is what takes us to peace.